Matthew chapter 5 tonight. It's very important to us to be here, not just tonight, but every occasion when we gather together for worship. We take this very seriously. We believe that God exists. We believe that He is a personal God, that we are created in His image, that we may have a relationship with Him, that we are like Him in some way. That's what it means to be made in His image. That He's interested in us, that He cares for us, not only as a group, but for each of us individually. And if we're the kind of people that He wants us to be, we can have that fellowship with Him that He desires, and that really deep down we desire as well. It's been said many times and by lots of people that there is within us this yearning to be in fellowship with God, and really we're not at rest until we are in fellowship with Him. And so we take this very seriously, our relationship with Him, coming together to worship Him, to hear from Him as we think about His Word, and as it teaches us the kind of people we ought to be. What kind of people is that? Say, if we're the kind of people He wants us to be, we can have fellowship with Him. But what kind of people is that? Well, He tells us what kind of people He wants us to be in the Scriptures. And there are lots of passages we could turn to, I'm sure, that might inform us as to what kind of people we ought to be. But I don't know that there are any that summarize it any better than Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 3 and going down through about verse 12 or so. Now, this is the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And I guess the Sermon on the Mount contains the fundamental teaching concerning the character that disciples of Jesus ought to develop. And the Beatitudes, this opening passage in the Sermon on the Mount, contain the fundamentals of that sermon. And so we want to turn to it. We began this a couple of weeks ago on Sunday night, but turn again to the Beatitudes and continue to think about what it has to say to us, what this passage has to say to us in our attempts to learn the kind of character we need to develop in order to have fellowship with our Creator and be ready to meet Him in the day of judgment. Now, I don't know that we're going to learn everything we need to know from this one passage. Especially, we might turn to other passages to supply the details that we need to know in developing this kind of character and the kind of person we need to be. But if we can master these things that are stated here, these principles that are stated here, we'll be well on our way to becoming what we ought to be. Notice that I say we'll be on our way to becoming what we ought to be. And I imagine it's a lifelong process. We're always in the stage of becoming what we ought to be. Even if we've been a Christian and a disciple of Jesus 20, 25, 30, 40, 50 years, we will still be becoming what we ought to be. It's interesting to me as you look at these, especially these opening statements. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That Jesus tells His disciples and is telling us that being a disciple does not begin with, now, as a disciple, I want you to do this, or I want you not to do that. It's not just a matter of doing or not doing some certain things. What He says is, I want you to be this. I want you to be these things. And so we become the kind of people, the way I say it, and makes sense to me, I don't know if it makes sense to anybody else, is we become what He wants us to be from the inside out. And so He's shaping our heart and shaping our mind and shaping our character, and then that produces actions. Then from that heart and from that character, we do the things that He asks us to do. And we refrain from doing the things that He forbids. And so that's the Sermon on the Mount, and especially these Beatitudes. What kind of people ought we be? Not just what things should we do or what things should we not do. What should we be? And we're continually and continuously developing into the kind of people that we ought to be. Well, we talked about the first one and the second, first Beatitude and the second Beatitude last time we talked about these things. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those that humble themselves in the sight of the Lord, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. We talked about Isaiah's reaction, woe is me, I'm undone, I'm a man of unclean lips. And the reaction of others when they come into the presence of God, overwhelmed by their own sense of unworthiness and sinfulness before God. And so they mourn about that. They're mourning about the right things in the right way. And tonight we're going to talk about verse 5 and then 6 and 7. At least that's my plan anyway. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And so let's talk about that for a little while. Blessed are the meek, or blessed are the gentle. New American Standard Bible says gentle. Maybe other versions do as well. For they shall inherit the earth. Two questions I'll raise in connection with this particular statement. Who are the meek, and what does it mean to inherit the earth? And so, blessed are the meek. Well, what does he mean, blessed are the meek? And again, what does he mean when he promises that the meek will inherit the earth? Well, the word translated meek in some versions, and then gentle in other versions, when you find different versions translating words differently like that, that's an indication that this word covers a wide range of territory. There are a lot of ideas conveyed and contained in this particular word. And so this word, like many words, has a wide range of meaning. And it's difficult to choose one English word that will adequately convey all the entire range of meaning. If you're translating, you know, if you're translating the New Testament, or if you're translating any document, you've got to choose one word. You can't put a series of words, just have to choose one and hope that people will be inclined to study it more thoroughly. And so, blessed are the meek, blessed are the gentle. So, this word means to be gentle or humble, considerate, lowly, mild, unassuming, yielding, forbearing, maybe even friendly in some contexts. An animal, and when this word is used to describe an animal, it's describing an animal that has been tamed. All right, so some animals are wild and uncontrolled and uncontrollable, but if an animal is meek or gentle, using this particular word, well, you can control it. It's gentle now. It's tame. And so this word, maybe that gives us some insight into the meaning of the word. It's used of the poor and those of humble circumstances in life. They are meek. Its opposite is proud and arrogant, conceited, self-promoting, a braggart, egotistical, narcissistic, bombastic. Now that's the opposite of meek. Now, those qualities are very attractive to the world. Proud, conceited, self-promoting. Got any self-promoters in the world today? Braggarts, bombastic. Any people bombastic in the world today? Yeah, I think there are some of those making lots of money today. But are they meek? No. You wouldn't call them meek. That's the opposite of being meek. It was a characteristic of Jesus. So let's think about Jesus in connection with this idea. Look at Matthew chapter 21. Jesus is entering into the city of Jerusalem at the beginning of that last week of his life. Matthew 21, beginning in verse 5, says, "Say to the daughter of Zion," quotation from Zechariah chapter 9. Jesus is entering into the city, riding on a donkey. And so it says, "Say to the daughter of Zion," Matthew's quoting this passage. Verse 4 says, "This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you. Gentle," there's our word, gentle, meek, "and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a beast of burden." So Jesus embodies this characteristic. Jesus is meek. See it again in Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 and 29. "Come to me," Jesus says, "all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am meek and lowly," or gentle and humble in heart, "and you shall find rest to your souls. My yoke is easy, my burden is light." Jesus, meek and humble. And yet, Jesus has strong character, doesn't he? He has strong character. And so being meek is not being a wimp, you know, and just letting people push you around. And, you know, you have strong character. Jesus had strong convictions. And, you know, to today's way of saying things, Jesus was willing to speak truth to power, wasn't he? He was willing to stand up to those who had the power. In some ways, power over him. They had his life or death in his hands, at least as far as this life is concerned. And he was willing to speak the truth to them. Now, so meekness is not weakness, is it? Now, Jesus was meek, but strong, strong character, strong conviction. Yet he was born without fanfare. He was laid in a manger. He was subject to his parents all his life. And here's the man that's meek. And yet he's subject to his parents, subject to those who are in authority over him. He lived as a working man, just making a living with his hands throughout first part of his life. He was a carpenter. Just it could have been, you know, it could have been the kind of person or occupied the kind of position that drew a lot of attention and fanfare and prestige and pomp to himself. But no, just a carpenter. Very, very meek, wasn't he? Always submitting to the will of his father. When he was reviled, he did not respond in kind. When he was lied about, he didn't threaten in return. And finally, crucified on a Roman cross. Strong in character, strong in conviction, willing to speak truth to power, but at the same time, meek and gentle. Of course, we're called upon to develop this same characteristic. And look at a couple of passages with me. Colossians 3 and verse 12. So as those who have been chosen by God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness or meekness, and patience. And so we're called upon to develop this same kind of quality. Strong character, strong conviction, always submitting to the will of God. And so think about that animal that's tame and subject to the will of his master. And so we're sort of tame. We're not rebellious, like a wild animal breaking free, submitting our will to the will of our master, our father, willing to stand, not a weakling, not a pushover, yet gentle, mild, lowly, humble. How did Jesus react when he was falsely accused? How did he react when they made false accusations against him? Did he bow up and get in somebody's face and let him have it? No. Did he get in a shouting match? Now, where he answered shout and accusation and insult with shout and accusation and insult? Did he become angry and storm out of the room and slam the door? No, he didn't do any of those things, did he? And so when we're put in those situations, when we're falsely accused, when we're attacked, how do we respond? Not a pushover, not weak. We stand our ground. We hold to our convictions, and yet gentle and mild and humble, like Jesus responded. So maybe we get some insight into what Jesus means when he says, "Blessed are the meek." Now, they shall inherit the earth. What does that mean? Well, that's been a challenge to Bible students through the years. Does Jesus mean that the righteous somehow will rule over the earth, perhaps a renovated earth, that they're going to rule over? You know, Jesus is going to come and the earth, the physical earth, is somehow going to be renovated, and we're going to, you know, God's people are going to rule over it. Well, the Bible teaches us, of course, that the earth and its works are going to be destroyed. And so I don't think that that's what he has in mind. May it be a reference to a new heaven and new earth that we're waiting for? Or might it mean that in some way we are the true possessors of heaven and or the true possessors of earth? You might remember 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 21 through 23. So then, let no one boast in men, for all things belong to you, Paul says, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all things belong to you, and you belong to Christ and Christ belongs to God. Is that what he has in mind? That in some spiritual way, the world belongs to you. You know, blessed are the meek, you'll inherit the earth. And so this has been a challenge for Bible students through the years, but let me just suggest this idea to you. The word translated earth may also be translated land. It's the word from which we get the word geology, a study of the land. It refers to the land of Canaan that was inherited by Israel. And so if you go to Acts chapter 7, for example, and look at Stephen's sermon there, Acts chapter 7, verse 2, he said, "Hear me, brethren and fathers, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he is in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran. And he said, leave your country and your relatives and come into the land that I'm going to give you." That's our word right there. The land, that's the promised land, isn't it? That God is going to give to Abraham. If you go back into the Old Testament, let's say the book of Deuteronomy, there are several times that this word is used in reference to the land that Israel was going to inherit. And so, for example, Deuteronomy chapter 3 and verse 28, "Charge Joshua and encourage him and strengthen him, for he shall go across at the head of this people, and he will give them as an inheritance the land which you will see." And so for Israel, the promise was that they are going to inherit the land. And that kind of language is used a number of times in the Old Testament, especially in the book of Deuteronomy. There's no greater blessing that God bestowed upon Israel than the promised land. You're going to inherit the land. This is God's greatest blessing for Israel. In the prophets, this kind of language and terminology is used in a messianic context or messianic contexts. The Old Testament prophets spoke of the blessings of the new covenant using this kind of language, inheriting the land. And so the prophets used language and terminology that the people were familiar with, but they invested it with new spiritual meaning. And so in the messianic kingdom, we're going to inherit the land. And understood spiritually and figuratively, again, we're going to enjoy God's greatest blessings, God's greatest covenant blessings for us. So Jeremiah 3 verse 18 says, "How I would set you among my sons." I think I'm going to turn over there and read a couple of verses prior to that one. Jeremiah chapter 3. Let's begin reading in verse 15. Verse 14, he says, "Return, O faithless sons, declares the Lord, and I will bring you to Zion. Then I will give you shepherds after my own heart, who will feed you on knowledge and understanding. It shall be in those days," which is often a reference to the messianic age, "it shall be in those days when you are multiplied and increased in the land, declares the Lord, they will no longer say, the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and it will not come to mind, nor will they remember it, nor will they miss it, nor will it be made again." And so that the covenant, we have a new temple in the church, and Christ is our new high priest, and he atones for our sacrifices. "At that time, they will call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations will be gathered to it, to Jerusalem, for the name of the Lord. Nor will they walk anymore after the stubbornness of their evil heart. In those days, the house of Judah will walk with the house of Israel, and they will come together from the land of the north and the land to the land that I gave your fathers as an inheritance." So that's a description of the messianic age in prophetic language. Then I said, "How I would set you among my sons and give you a pleasant land, the most beautiful inheritance of the nations." And I said, "You shall call me my father and not turn away from following me." And so the prophets look forward to a time when Israel, spiritual Israel, would inherit the land, enjoy God's greatest blessing, all the blessings of the new covenant. And so is that what Jesus is saying? Blessed are the meek, blessed are the gentle. Blessed are those who develop the same character that Christ possessed. They will enjoy all the blessings that the new covenant has to offer. Well, let's look at the next, verse 6, the next beatitude. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Righteousness in the book of Matthew refers to right conduct that springs from godly character. And so John the Baptist came in the way of righteousness. Matthew chapter 21 and verse 32. And so it's a way of life, isn't it? The way of righteousness. It's a lifestyle, doing the right things and doing the right things out of the right kind of character. Jesus warns not to do your righteousness to be seen by men in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 1. And then he proceeds to teach us how righteous deeds should be done. And so righteousness is something that we do in the book of Matthew. But righteousness is more than just doing the right things. Righteousness must be done from the right attitude. And so Jesus says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you'll not enter the kingdom of heaven. And so he's talking about the right attitude. He goes on to talk about not only not murdering, but not being angry with your brother. And so our righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And so it's not just doing right things, but right things with the right attitude. Again, being right from the inside out. Righteous people are those who sincerely live according to the way of righteousness because they develop righteous character. Someone has said that the idea here, blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, is that God's blessing is on those who are eager to live as God requires. I thought that summed it up pretty well. Those who hunger and thirst after righteousness are those who are eager to live as God requires. Jesus describes this eagerness, you know, eager to live as God requires. Jesus describes that eagerness in pretty vivid language. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. We know hunger in only a superficial way, don't we? And so gets to a certain point in the middle of the day, and we're hungry. So what do? We may open our lunchbox and eat our lunch, or go to the refrigerator or the pantry and get something out of and fix it and eat lunch. We might drive through somewhere and eat lunch. You know, so we get hungry, but our hunger is very easily satisfied. But in some parts of the world, as we've seen, people really know what it is to be hungry. They know what it is to be thirsty. Some places there's a scarcity of drinking water. And so people have to walk for long distances just to find a source of water that they can drink. And so they know what it is to be hungry and to be thirsty. And so Jesus uses that description to teach us what it means to be eager to live as God requires. Jesus describes people who are on a quest to discover the way of righteousness who will not stop until they learn it. Can you think of any good Bible examples of that? Can you think of anybody in the Bible, maybe the New Testament, even Old Testament, who was on a quest to discover, to find out how they ought to live, what kind of people they ought to be? Maybe you can't. Here, I thought about Zacchaeus. Remember Zacchaeus, Luke chapter 19? He was a wee little man. You remember that? Zacchaeus was a wee little man, chief tax collector. He learned that Jesus was coming to his town and he wanted to see Jesus. And so he went out to where the crowds were. Again, he's a small man, couldn't see. And so he didn't let that stop him, didn't let his size stop him, didn't let the fact that there were others who were crowding him out stop him, climbed up in a tree so that he could see Jesus. Jesus found Zacchaeus and went to his house. There's an example of a man who was eager to live as God requires. The Bereans, another good example, searched the scriptures daily to find out if the things that were being preached were true. Do we have a hunger and thirst for righteousness? It's one thing, you know, to go through some religious rituals every so often, once a week, twice a week, three times a week for that matter. That's one thing to kind of go through some religious exercises. It's another thing altogether to hunger and thirst for righteousness. How are we doing? Doing okay with that? Do you have that hunger? Do you have that thirst for righteousness? Do you have that intense desire, craving to find out what God would have us to do and then put that into practice? Well, Jesus promises that those who hunger and thirst for righteousness will be filled. They will be satisfied. In Matthew chapter 4, Jesus says, Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And so those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, they feed on the Word of God. The one who seeks will find, Jesus says. The word "they will be filled" suggests that they're going to be filled full. We might say stuffed. Man, I'm stuffed. And so those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they're going to be filled. They're going to be stuffed. And it may be that if we're lacking in that department, maybe we haven't developed that hunger and that thirst, that intense desire and craving to learn what God would have us to be and do. I think it's probably a lifelong effort, don't you? That we'll never get to the point where we've learned enough. You know, we are exactly all that we should be. It's a lifelong development, hungering, thirsting for righteousness. Well, then let's look at the third one we're going to look at tonight. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Matthew chapter 5, verse 7. You know, we're interested in our culture, you know, seeing that people get what they deserve. I think about recently in the news, this guy that was associated with these gymnasts, you know, these girl gymnasts. And, you know, we sit there and we think, man, I hope he gets what he deserves. And rightfully so. But, you know, mercy is giving people what they don't deserve. That's what mercy is. Mercy extends compassion, kindness, goodness, generosity, grace, especially toward the helpless. I'm not suggesting that that guy ought to not be punished. Not suggesting that at all. But mercy is a quality that extends compassion toward the suffering, kindness toward those who are helpless, goodness to those who are in distress. That's mercy. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 2, there Paul in his salutation, the beginning of the letter, says, to Timothy, my true child in the faith, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and Christ Jesus our Lord. How might grace be distinguished from mercy? Well, it may be that grace has to do with our sin, whereas mercy has to do with our misery. And so someone is in misery, and we have mercy on them, we have pity toward them, and we seek to help in some way relieve the suffering and relieve the misery. And so it's pity with a desire to do something to relieve it. Remember in the story of the rich man and Lazarus, the rich man lifted up his eyes in torment. What did he want? Send Lazarus down. Have mercy on me. Send Lazarus down here. I'm in misery. I'm in anguish. I need someone to relieve the anguish and the misery and the suffering that I'm in. And so he pleads for mercy. As we see here in Matthew chapter 5 and other places, mercy is seen in the teaching of Jesus. Mercy is also seen in the miracles of Jesus. Here's a little mini sermon within a sermon. Mercy is seen through the miracles of Jesus. Matthew 20 and verse 29. As they were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him, and two blind men sitting by the road, hearing that Jesus was passing by, cried out, "Lord, have mercy on us, Son of David." The crowd sternly told them to be quiet, but they cried out all the more, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." And Jesus stopped, called them, and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "We want our eyes to be open, moved with compassion." Jesus touched their eyes, and immediately they regained their sight and followed him. We see the mercy of Christ in his miracles. As he cleanses the lepers, as he casts out demons, Jesus is having compassion on people, extending mercy to them. These people are not able to help themselves. The blind man couldn't restore his own sight. The lepers can't cleanse themselves. The demon possessed can't exorcise the demons themselves. So Jesus looks on them with compassion and pity, and he helps them when they are unable to help themselves. Mercy is seen in the stories of Jesus. We see it in Luke chapter 10. The lawyer stands up after saying, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus says, "Well, he stands up and he says to Jesus, 'Who is my neighbor?'" And remember, Jesus replied with the story of the Good Samaritan. The man's traveling down from Jerusalem to Jericho. He falls among robbers. They strip him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And a priest was going by that way and saw him and passed by on the other side of the road. A Levite, same thing, saw the man, passed by on the other side of the road. But a Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him. When he saw him, he felt compassion, came to him, bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. He put him on his beast, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. Had mercy on him. In this particular case, here's a man who's a Samaritan, crossing these social boundaries, you know. Here's a Jew that's fallen among thieves and he's beaten and left half dead. Here's a Samaritan that's reaching out, crossing these barriers to help this man, to show him some compassion, to have mercy on him. We might learn some lessons from that. So mercy is seen in the teaching of Jesus. Mercy is seen in the stories of Jesus. Mercy is seen in the miracles of Jesus. And mercy is seen in the cross of Jesus as well. Look at Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2. We'll begin reading in... let's just begin reading in... Verse 1 describes our situation. We were dead in our trespasses and sins. Talks about that a little bit. And then verse 4, but God, being rich in mercy, because of His great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Christ. By grace have you been saved. And of course, that is accomplished through the cross of Jesus. And so we see God's mercy exhibited in the cross of Jesus. And so we see mercy in the teaching of Jesus, in the miracles of Jesus, in the stories that Jesus tells, and in the cross of Jesus as well. Now, let me make this observation. If mercy addresses the misery of someone who is suffering, that's what we said earlier. That's what mercy is. It sees the misery, the suffering of a person and tries to help that person. Well, what does that say about our condition when we are in sin? You know, if we find ourselves estranged from God, I mean, do we suffer as a result? I mean, I don't mean does God inflict suffering on us. I mean, within us, is there misery? Is there any suffering? You know, is there any sort of feelings like that? Like Isaiah had, oh no, woe is me. I'm undone. I'm a man of unclean lips. I've fallen into sin. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm separated and estranged from God. What am I going to do? And we're in a state of misery. Now, I think all too often that's not the case. Now, we sin, but we take it kind of casually and we trivialize it. There's not this grieving and suffering, anguish within the spirit, misery. And yet, you know, that's the kind of thing that God sent His Son to relieve in us. God's always expected mercy from His people. The law contained requirements that if Israel carried them out the way they should have, would relieve the suffering and the misery of the poor, like gleaning the field. They weren't to glean the entire or harvest the entire field, but leave the corners of the field, the boundaries of the field for the poor so that they could come and they could gather for themselves the food that they needed. In the 41st Psalm, we find this statement at the very beginning, the 41st Psalm beginning in verse 1. How blessed is he who considers the helpless. The Lord will deliver him in a day of trouble. The Lord will protect him and keep him alive. He shall be called blessed upon the earth, and do not give him over to the desire of his enemies. Those are people that consider the helpless and try to relieve their sufferings. So God has always expected His people to be merciful. In Matthew chapter 9, Jesus says to the Pharisees, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Do we know what that means? You know what that means? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. If we don't know what that means, we need to go learn what that means. Because that's fundamental to being a disciple of Jesus. Jesus says that the merciful will receive mercy, that only those who possess the quality and show it to others will have it shown to them by God. So how are we doing in developing mercy? How are we doing with that? Is that a concern for us, that I want to become more merciful, a more merciful person? I want to show more mercy toward others? It's absolutely essential if we're going to be a disciple of Jesus. Now, we can't say, well, you know, of these eight, I've got seven pretty well taken care of, you know. If we're going to be a disciple, we need to be developing mercy. And as we said in the beginning, to a great extent, the Beatitudes are about becoming a certain kind of person, poor in spirit, developing a certain attitude toward his sin, being meek, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, being merciful. Being a disciple of Jesus makes great demands on us because it requires us to change the kind of person that we are. It's not just change what you do. Now, it involves that, but it's not just that. It says change what you are. And that's the greatest challenge of all, isn't it? Change what you are. And so we want to, that would be a lifelong project. We want to be very much involved in it every day from here on to the rest of our lives as disciples of Jesus. Well, we'll pick up there next time. If you're not a disciple of Jesus, we want you to think seriously about becoming a disciple of Jesus. It's demanding in many ways. It's demanding. It's going to require a great change in you, inwardly especially. But the rewards are great as well. And so if you'll commit to it and devote yourself to becoming what you ought to be as a disciple of Jesus, if all these benefits that we've been talking about here in the Beatitudes, are you ready? Do you believe in Jesus as the Son of God? Willing to repent, confess your faith, be united with Him in baptism? Are you ready? If so, we can help you with that tonight. If you're already a Christian, but you're not what you ought to be, you've fallen into sin, acknowledge it. Make no excuses. Don't shift the blame to anybody else like we talked about this morning. You say, I'm wrong. I did it. I'm sorry. I want to do better. And so if you're not right with God, and we can help you in some way, we invite you to come and as we stand and sing together.